Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us here for this week's show. We're going to be talking about mitigation of some disaster hazards and things. I think at least that's the topic I had come across my screen in the emails earlier today. And of course, that means I got an email from none other than Sam Bradley. Hey, Sam.
Hello, Jamie. Well, I hear it's a little cold back east there, but out here in Colorado, it actually got rather spring-like for a couple days, except for the winds we've had up here in the Front Range for the last couple days.
Don't talk to me about winds.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I live on the East Coast where we had the bomb cyclone hit us, which Kyle, I'm sure, will explain to us. Kyle's joining us as well, I think.
Yes, and Kyle, do tell. I think they have another nor'easter coming their way, do they not?
Hey, Sam, Jamie, and everyone out there on the podcast. Yes, definitely some active weather having just moved through the New England area, as well as another winter storm there on the way. So back-to-back nor'easters, and that's the second one on the way to you, Jamie, in just under 5 days. So the bomb cyclone that you talked about first, that was the big wind event that everyone's talking about in the Northeast. And so bomb cyclone, that's a term that refers to the extreme rate at which that low pressure system, which are the active weather makers in our atmosphere, deepened or as the pressure dropped. Kind of like the pressure in the center of a hurricane drops, in a low pressure system that drops as well. And we had, you know, pretty strong winds ahead of the cold front. That storm continued to deepen and as that storm continued to deepen and the pressure got lower, you know, wind is the movement of air from a high pressure area to a low pressure area. So as that storm got more intense and the pressure lowered, that pressure gradient, stay with me, between the area of high pressure to the west and low pressure just off the coast, as that got more intense, the winds got stronger. And so that's what generated those wind gusts. 97 miles per hour was the record that I found out on Cape Cod. And at one time, over 2 million without power there in the Northeast.
It was, so it was a pretty significant event. It was crazy. And I'll tell you, you know, I've been through hurricanes here in the East Coast. I live just north, right at the top of the Chesapeake Bay, just across the Susquehanna River, for those of you that know the area. And we have three bridges across the Susquehanna where we are. We have the dam, which is a bridge. We have a bridge that's about a mile long that sits very high up off the water farther down the coast from me. And then we have the another older bridge. It's kind of like a trestle bridge, which right next to that runs an old freight train trestle bridge. So here's what happened. The winds were so strong that they at one point they had shut down both of the highway bridges. The dam was the only way to get back and forth across the river. And then trees fell down on either side of the across Route 1 across the dam. So there was no way to get north or south from Maryland either way because the bridges were shut down because tractor trailers had flipped over because of the high winds on the I-95 bridge. And then the Route 40 bridge had a similar situation happening where a tractor trailer was blown into a vehicle running beside it and caused a jackknife situation. Then, and I'd never heard of this before, Kyle, the winds were so strong, it knocked four rail cars on a freight train, derailed the freight train partially, and knocked four rail cars into the river from the trestle bridge.
Oh, I hadn't heard about that.
It was nuts. And so people were, I mean, basically I-95 was at a standstill, like a parking lot. People were taking 5 hours to go 10 miles. And these were people that lived in the area because the back roads were so backed up because everybody was getting off of 95 trying to find another way to go north or south. And it was insane. People were like opening their homes up for people to stay with them, and restaurants that were closed were opening because people didn't have anywhere to eat. And I was really proud of my county. We kind of stepped up and helped people out, and that was a good thing. And I was proud to see that. But you know, for people, we've lived through hurricanes. We've lived through a lot of things. We've never seen winds affect us that way before.
Wow. So, Kyle, is this going to be a repeat coming in?
So the storm that's coming in, it's going to bring some wind with it, not nearly as intense as this last storm. However, this one, you get the added sugarcoating effect of some snow that's moving into the northeast as well. So not only some high winds, but some snowfall as well. So definitely some compounding factors, blizzard conditions very, very likely throughout the New England states. And stay tuned to local TV or your local National Weather Service office for the latest updates for your area.
So hunker down, Jamie, but this isn't the first time you've done it. So
No, we'll be in good shape. I'm not worried. You know, actually, we're on the southern end of the effect. I think we're only going to get maybe 4 to 6 inches of snow, and that's livable. We can get through that, no problem. It'll probably, knowing Maryland, it'll be melted within, you know, a day all by itself if I don't touch it. So
you can tell you're from New England, Jamie. Only 4 to 6 inches of snow.
I'm not even in New England. They're going to get like 12 inches farther up. I mean, we're in mid-Atlantic area here. I mean, go up the coast to northern New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, up in that area, they're going to get upwards of 12 inches of snow from this event. So it's going to be significant impacts, I think.
Well, it's a good thing your out-of-town trip is over and you can stay home and create podcasts while
that's the plan.
Very good. Well, we have a great guest tonight. This started because we were actually an email went to you, I believe, on the website from Raphael Lemaitre, who's a former director of public affairs at FEMA, and was very interested, asked if we would be interested in a discussion on mitigation after a storm. It's like, absolutely, because that's something we haven't talked too much about. So basically, he hooked us up with Brian Kuhn, who's the former head of Florida's Emergency Management Agency, and he was just elected chair of the Multi-Hazard Committee, which put out a recent report on the importance of mitigation. So as Raphael told us, he would love to talk about his experience dealing with disasters in Florida and the role mitigation should play as we recover from the worst hurricane season in a very long time. And to top it off, he is now in Puerto Rico. So after we discuss mitigation a bit, I'd like to ask him what he's doing down there. So hi, Brian. Tell us a little more about yourself.
Well, hi, guys. Thanks for having me. You know, after that last description of the snowstorm that's going on right now, I'm really glad that I'm in Puerto Rico, and I'm really glad that I was a director of emergency management for the state of Florida. I don't think I would have enjoyed having to deal with the bomb cyclone and blizzards. I'm happy with the warmer weather disasters that we did have. They were more my style.
Well, Florida certainly has its own issues, just not as cold.
They are. But thanks for having me. Again, I really appreciate it. I'm excited to be with you all tonight. You know, I've been in emergency management for a long time, and it's always been one of the passions that got me into emergency management was the mitigation side of things, recognizing that we're going to continue to have disasters, frequent disasters. We're going to have more disasters. We're going to have worse disasters. But recognizing that there are things that we can do as individuals, as communities, to help get ready for them and reduce the impacts of them. And you know, one of the primary things that I always focused on as director in the state of Florida was life safety. You know, I want to save as many lives as possible. I don't want people to perish unnecessarily, particularly when we've gotten to the point with technology and science that we know these things are coming. We've got a pretty good ability to forecast tornadoes, hurricanes, bomb cyclones. And I want to make sure that we build our communities to prepare for them so that the people can survive them and that our communities can survive them. And so helping to spread, if you will, the gospel of mitigation and helping people understand, you know, some of the simple things they can do to get themselves and their homes and their communities ready for it are really going to make us much better off as society. And so I'm excited to be involved in mitigation in any way I can.
Absolutely. Well, I want to go through some of the points that he sent me because I think they're well framed, and then you can talk more about it. His first point was natural hazards present significant risk to many communities across the United States. just as you were saying. Fortunately, there are measures governments, building owners, developers, tenants, and others can take to reduce the impact of such events. Natural disasters cause billions in damages and significant human suffering, much of which could be avoided by strategic local zoning, adopting more stringent codes, and using FEMA building science guidance and other tools for new and retrofit construction. So that's kind of a big bite. What would you like to say about that one?
Well, you know, one of the challenges you face when you talk about mitigation is helping people understand what's the return on investment for them. You know, Americans, humans are optimistic, I think, in general. And so when they design a building and you talk about, hey, if you harden it, you need to harden it to this level of flooding, you need to be ready for these kinds of winds. I think sometimes we become overly optimistic in those scenarios and we say, well, that's really expensive. You know, if I don't do that, I can add in these additional features to my building or save these dollars and I'll roll the dice when it comes to, you know, that disaster ever happening. Because, you know, I've lived here for a long time. I haven't seen that level of disaster. How likely is that going to occur? Unfortunately, when you roll that up to a state or to a nation, it does happen. And then you, those folks who didn't build accordingly or prepare accordingly are left, you know, in a dire situation where they're just not quite sure how they're going to get their lives back to normal. And so a lot of the work that the Multi-Hazard Mitigation Council has done with this new report is really try to quantify that and put it in a way so that when people are making those economic decisions in terms of how they're going to use their scarce resources, in this case, their dollars, that we can help provide them the data necessary to justify the additional cost to harden that facility and to build that facility in a way that it's going to survive the disasters that are possible in that community. And that's really what we're trying to do there. It's, again, just try to help provide some of the economic justification for decision makers so that they will spend the extra few dollars to make that building, that community survivable. Because again, on the back end, the savings, I mean, the life safety alone justifies it, but the economic savings associated with these kind of mitigation efforts, we're just trying to demonstrate to people and quantify that for them so they can be justified in those decisions.
Gee, disaster preparedness, what a concept. But one of the things I'm not real clear about, what about strategic local zoning? How does that come into play?
Well, so a lot of what we talk about in the report and in general is mitigation doesn't have to be, sometimes when we talk about mitigation, a lot of times what we're talking about is capital M mitigation, you know, mitigation that is funded by somebody, typically the federal government, you know, more so than the state and local government, but mitigation that goes in, dollars that go in there and either go in and retrofit a facility to harden it, or maybe it's a new facility and you're paying for it. So we tend to think of mitigation with a capital M because that's what the program's called. It comes with dollars. But what we're really trying to talk about is mitigation with a lowercase m. You know, mitigation, the common sense stuff that existed well before any governmental program to help fund it. The lowercase m mitigation, which just leads you to build better based on the disasters that you are going to face. And that starts with your local building codes. If you, as a community, decide that it's important for you to have structures that are going to survive the next disaster, you reinforce that. You enforce that through your building codes. You tell the people who are building those buildings, listen, this is important to us. We want our residents to survive. We want our buildings to survive. We want our community to survive. Here are the hazards we face. This is the minimum standard that you need to have in place to build a building in our community, and we're going to enforce it. And the stronger that local building code is, the better off that community is going to be post-disaster. And so that's what we talk about in this new study. Briefly, the National Institute of Building Sciences Multi-Hazard Mitigation Council, and you referenced, I'm the president of that currently, started this in 2005 with a study that investigated what's the return on investment for federal dollars in mitigation. We just updated it last year. But we added that new component, that building code component, to say, listen, what if there weren't a federal investment in mitigation? How, what other ways can we do get there to harden our buildings? So we looked at the building code and showed that if you exceed the building code, and a building code is just the baseline. If you go beyond that, you get a 4-to-1 return investment on the money that you put into that hardening. So again, trying to help convince local government officials that it's in their best interest to have strong building codes in their communities and to enforce those building codes.
That sure makes sense to me. So Jamie, just curiosity, but were there any building issues with all the wind in your part of the world?
Yeah, there were. We had some buildings, mostly roof damage, especially it seemed with commercial buildings. Some people I know, neighbors, lost some of their like vinyl siding or things like that. But I know several commercial buildings, including a local high school, lost like the roof of their auditorium came off. And they basically said it peeled back like a can of tuna. So,
wow.
You know, just all of a sudden it was laying on the parking lot next to the building. You have to be prepared, and this high school's quite old, so I suspect maybe it wasn't built, or the standards weren't the same as they are today. And that's probably something we can talk about, because you can have building codes for earthquakes or for tornadoes or for hurricanes or whatever the case may be, but they don't grant, you know, they grandfather in older structures so that they don't have to become compliant. Because it would be too much to retrofit, but I'm sure that's something you guys all look at as well. Isn't that correct, Brian?
Yeah, it is. And you know, I tell people, as an emergency manager, my ideal community would be one which was completely made of concrete, that had no windows, that's probably covered up in dirt. So basically, it was impregnable to any kind of disaster. You know, that's my ideal community. Of course, nobody wants to live in my ideal community, and so everything else is a compromise. You know, how do we build our buildings in a way that they are both affordable and attractive, and you know, provide us an appropriate level of safety? And that's where the building codes come in, which is, you know, what is the appropriate level of investment that we want to make to reach that level of safety? But yeah, you have to consider the economic side of this. It is not at all solely based on how hard can you build the building, because you can build a building that will, no disaster will impact, but again, nobody wants to live there. So it's the compromise between what is economically viable and what is appropriate based on the hazards that you face there. And again, that's kind of why this study is done, is to show the middle ground there. You know, if you spend this little bit much extra on the hardening, this is the return that you can expect, because we're, again, trying to move the needle more towards the hardened building and help justify the expenditures that people want to make in that area.
Wow, really. On that note, speaking of money, one of the points that were made was the study shows a savings of $15.5 billion from 1 year of building new construction beyond code requirements, and $158 billion in savings from federally funded mitigation grant programs funded between 1993 and 2016. So that's pretty much what you're talking about, right?
That's right. You know, it's anybody who's in this field, and I imagine that most of your listeners are, recognize how expensive it is to respond to and recover from a disaster. When you're out there in the field, all your first responders are assisting and helping to rescue people. You're setting up the shelters. You're turning on the programs to help people get back up with their lives. You're rebuilding quickly. All of that's extremely expensive. If you can avoid that by just spending a bit extra on roofs and some more on, you know, windows and siding and things like that, the savings are tremendous. And so that's what we try to point out in this study, is that for those people who make those economic decisions, think big picture, in that, you know, you're either going to pay some now or a whole lot more later on. And although that is intuitive, It often doesn't factor into the equation until you can quantify it. And so that's what we've been trying to do here, is help provide that level of quantification. So when Congress or state legislators are determining how much to appropriate for a mitigation program, they can look at this and say, you know, so basically we're saying it's 6-to-1 return on investment. You know, if you're willing to spend $1 million extra on mitigation, you're going to save in the long term $6 million. Your taxpayers are going to thank you for that. So it's, again, helping people justify those investments.
And we're living through that right now with the, you know, the additional funding that's needed for Texas, for Florida, for Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, certainly, as they're still rebuilding. I had a friend, I was at a conference last weekend in Texas, and she, one of the people attending with me, was then heading down to Rockport on the Gulf Coast to visit her parents, who had just bought a home there. And, you know, literally were moved in like a month before the hurricane hit. And that luckily their house had almost no damage, but the houses on either side of them were leveled. And I wish I'd known this to talk to her about it. I wonder if that house was newer construction and perhaps more hardened against the forces of the hurricane.
It almost seems certain. Well, you know, another point here, just listening to Jamie's story, is people aren't realizing that different events are occurring in parts of the country where they may not have occurred before. You know, wind issues aren't as common on the East Coast as they may be somewhere else. I don't know, Kyle, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, Sam, I think kind of what we're hinting at here is how our climate and our global climate is changing with, you know, as things progress here. And it's not something that we can just brush away or deny or make political, but it's absolutely something that, you know, to take into account. And so, as Brian hinted at, you know, looking at money invested now to protect against, you know, these, you know, hazards in the future, we also have to be sure at, you know, at the local level, especially where the change can truly be made and the difference can be made, not just focusing on one particular hazard that affects your area the most, nor just past or current events, but we have to consider how the hazards that you, that we experience or you experience locally, will change in the face of global climate change. You may not see them immediately. It may not be as apparent, perhaps, as, you know, communities in the coastal areas are experiencing with sea level rise and things of that nature. But, you know, in time, global climate change will touch and impact every community worldwide.
In ways that they would not now expect, I suppose. So, Brian, this next point, you may have to help me with the mnemonics here. In this new study, NIBSMMC examined 23 years of federal grants data to determine the BCR for mitigation grants and examined or expanded set of mitigation tactics to determine the BCR of building new structures beyond code requirements. The hazard categories covered this in the study are riverine flood, hurricane surge, wind, earthquake, and wildland urban interface fire. A lot of, I come from California, so I understand that one. So can you make that a little more palatable?
I'll do what I can on that. So the NIBS part is the National Institute of Building Sciences. And if you want to read more about them, that's the, it's at the NIBS.org, NIBS.org. Within the National Institute of Building Sciences, which is designed to help disseminate best practices and emerging technology in building sciences, there's a few councils. One of them is called the Multi-Hazard Mitigation Council, and it's made up of stakeholders who are engaged in, as it says, a variety of hazards. All, you know, anything that could impact the built environment, we're engaged with it, and we're part of the part of NIBS that, that focuses on trying to find ways to help communities and individuals understand ways that they can build better and stronger and prepare for the future. The BCR part of that, the benefit cost ratio, that's a phrase you hear a lot when people are trying to figure out whether to invest in mitigation. And anybody who's been engaged with any kind of mitigation programs has come across that, because basically you're trying to justify your project. So if you were going to build, say, a seawall you're trying to show the folks who are funding that, that, hey, this $1 million we invest in this seawall is going to help us prevent, you know, $3 million, $4 million, $5 million worth of damage due to flooding. Or this stormwater project is going to save us X amount of money over time, or whatever the case may be. It's really the term that people use to help justify the expenditure on that project. It's difficult to do sometimes because disasters in a, you know, a specific disaster in a specific location doesn't happen on any kind of cycle that, that allows you to calculate that easily. You know, but if you aggregate that across the country, you can come up with a kind of number. So say, for example, I used the seawall. When I was the director of emergency management, we built a seawall in St. Augustine, Florida. St. Augustine, Florida, you know, doesn't flood every 10 years on the dot. So it's difficult to say that if we invest $1 million here, that in the next 10 years, we're going to get our money back. You don't know that. But when you aggregate that data across the country, we can say, you know, that project and all of the projects are going to average this return on their investment. And that's what the study really does, is aggregates all of that information and said, hey, the nation has saved as a whole $158 billion based on the monies that it put in to mitigation. And so that's the point of it, is to help, again, those local decision makers in St. Augustine, the state of Florida, say this project is worth it because we know that over time, we're going to get our money back on this, and sixfold. We're going to save six, you know, if we invest $1 million, we're going to save $6 million in not having to respond to those disasters, not have to recover from and rebuild, economic loss, those kinds of things. And so that's what the NIBS, MMC, and BCR part of that mean, which is we're just helping to quantify in the aggregate, the return that the nation enjoys by investing in hardening our infrastructure.
Yeah, Jamie put the NIBS link up in our chat room, so I'm sure he'll put that up on the website in the show notes also. But to what you're saying, I really kind of like this next point. Mitigation program implementation saves our nation money, which is you were just saying. The new data shows that money spent exceeding select provisions of the 2015 model building code saves the nation $4 for every dollar spent, and mitigation grants funded through select government agencies saves the nation $6 for every $1 spent in losses avoided. The below, you know, just refers to the 2016 dollars, but I like this too. Mm-hmm. In addition to the benefits of losses avoided, approximately 87,000 jobs would be added nationwide. The study further estimates that mitigation investments would prevent more than hundreds of deaths, injuries, and causes of post-traumatic stress disorder. That's a pretty big statement, but you know, we're not just thinking in dollars here. We're thinking in effects on human lives more than just initial injuries and illnesses. Wow, can you speak to that?
Yeah, that's right. You know, frankly, to me, the more important part is the hundreds of lives and the injuries and the post-traumatic stress disorder. But economic decisions are not always based on those numbers. And so you lead in this kind of situation with the dollars saved on the physical buildings and those kinds of things. And if that's not enough, the number of people you can hire with these funds to go out and do this work. What we're trying to do is basically amplify all of the good things that come out of, as a result of investing in mitigation. And I think, you know, this study was originally released in 2005, and most people in the emergency management disaster world have heard that factor before. They've heard that 4-to-1 return on investment, but the study was over 12 years old. We needed to get in there and show the new data because we had 12 years worth of disasters that we could go in and quantify, the impacts from the mitigation efforts that had been undertaken. And we added in a few new things as well, like the reduction in the in post-traumatic stress disorder and the costs associated with that. We added in the building code piece of it. We added in the number of jobs that would be generated. Again, all in an effort to try to help people understand the positive impacts that investing in mitigation has on society, and on taxpayers. And so all of these things are positive, and that's really what we're trying to get across.
And it's a lot more than just dollars and cents, and I like the way that's phrased. Our final comment on mitigation, achieving resilience relies on actions and investments by both the public and private sector, with benefits also accruing to each sector. The 2017 interim report developed by the Institute shows an expanded look at the sources of mitigation and the numerous benefits for different stakeholders beyond just federal spending impact. So basically that kind of capsulized everything you've been saying. Any further thoughts on that?
Well, again, the initial study was done just to show the return on investment of the federal dollar. This study has gone beyond that to say it doesn't matter who's making the investment, the return is there. So if you are a private entity and you are building buildings for your business, the return on investment is there for you. If you were an individual investing in your home, the return on investment is there for you. If you are a community working on your building codes, the return on investment is there for you. So all of society benefits from this. And that's really the interesting thing that the new study has in there compared to the one 12 years ago. We've expanded the factors that we look at and simultaneously expanded the people, the stakeholders who for whom we show the return on investment there. And while I'm there, let me give a plug to people. Go to NIBS.org. You can download. There's two things you can read. One is the 12-page executive summary of the report, and that gives you the gist of it. And if you really want to dive into it, you can pull up the 300 pages that shows all the data and the methodology behind the study itself. So those are for the folks who are really hardcore about mitigation and want to understand exactly what we did to make this happen.
And hopefully they're out there. Thoughts, Jamie?
Oh, I know they're out there. If they're listening to this podcast,
yeah, they're out
those
there.
Are the folks that are probably going to read the 300 pages.
I think we do have some of them.
Yeah, and
I'm sure you do.
We've talked about the building research that goes on with some of our other guests in the past, looking at new materials and new building methods and all those things that happen because of the research that helps develop these standards. And so it's really a multi, like you said, there are multiple stakeholders involved with this, Brian. It's not just the federal government or the state and local governments, but it's businesses, it's individuals, it's the research that's happening in the universities, in their engineering departments across the country. All of these things come together to produce a more resilient, safer nation.
That's right. That's right. It's the insurance companies. It's the chambers of commerce. It's the it's the family groups. It's all of us. All of us. I love mitigation because we all have the same goal here. Nobody is arguing about the goal on this one, which is to save lives and reduce property damage. Nobody wants anything different than those two goals. So it's a matter of how do we go about achieving it? And that's an exciting place to be, is to help provide the data for people to come together on that mutual decision.
Makes perfect sense. Kyle, any thoughts?
I'm just stoked on this discussion here.
I knew you would be.
Oh yeah. I'm a big, big proponent, as a meteorologist and, with emergency management background, this is a topic near and dear to my heart. And it's one that I like a lot of the points that were touched on, where it's taken in as a multi-hazard approach, where we're not just engineering against wind damage from hurricanes, but also from big, very big wind storms like Jamie just experienced in the Northeast. The same as, we need to also look at things from that community-wide approach and keeping in mind, your year-end goal. And at the end of the day, protect, lives and property and things like that. But also, look at, from your first responders and the folks that are going to make the immediate difference during and after the storm as well. So keeping in mind that, mitigation may not just be, performing actions and performing corrective actions, but also as employing adaptation strategies, because we may not be able to prevent future disasters or their effects, but we can adapt our communities and, to the projected effects of future hazards in the face of global climate change, and as and through that we can become more resilient as a whole community.
And that's the way I well, you know, I talked about wind event, but that wind also had other effects because we're in a waterfront area in our part of the state, and as the wind was coming through at low tide, it pushed all the water out of the harbors. So that all the fishing boats and the pleasure craft and stuff tied up in the marinas were resting on the muddy bottom. And then as the high tide came back in, the wind had changed direction again, and we had significant storm surge come in and crest over the tops of the banks in certain areas, causing localized flooding. So again, it's like you said, it's that multi-hazards approach that you need to be prepared for not just one type of emergency, but that sometimes, in fact, frequently, these things present with multiple effects at the same time.
True. So, Brian, I mentioned that Dr. Josie Usardoc, and I am a training officer for a DMAT, so both of us were deployed for all three hurricanes, but you know what it is we do, but tell us about your experience, especially with Florida hurricanes.
Well, I might have run into you because I ran across a lot of DMATs in Florida. Were you in the Keys by any chance?
No, I actually ended up mostly in North Carolina. I'm on a specialized team that does evacuation out and in. So I would, you know, there's only two of us. So I wasn't really with a team, or I actually almost ended up in Puerto Rico, but that didn't work out. But yeah, who knows, we yet may cross each other's path. So what does someone with your expertise, yeah, there will be more. So what does someone with your expertise do during a hurricane?
Well, you know, so my job during Irma, I was the director of the Division of Emergency Management for the state of Florida and oversaw our state emergency response team. So I was the governor's, I worked directly for the governor of the state of Florida, and our role at the state of Florida was to assist all of the county and local governments in preparing for and responding to that disaster, making sure they had the appropriate staffing, resources, coordinating the actions between the counties, interfacing with the federal government and their, you know, what they were working on. It was a very, challenging storm, and it was a very rewarding storm. You know, we set a lot of records in Florida for a state that has been through as many hurricanes as it has. We set some records I didn't really want to set. We evacuated more people than had ever been evacuated in the state of Florida. We evacuated 6.8 million people. We had more power outage than had ever been experienced before. Roughly two-thirds of the state was without power during that storm. About 13 million people lost power during Irma. We opened more shelters than had ever been opened before, 602 shelters. At the height of the storm. So it was a gigantic storm. But everything went, you know, obviously these disasters have lots of, you know, things that you had not planned for. It all turned out well. But overall, went fairly according to how we had trained for it, how we had planned for it, how we'd exercised for it. And so we executed very well. I was pleased with how we executed. The citizens of the state of Florida stepped up and did what they needed to do in getting themselves and their families to a place of safety, which drastically reduced the loss of life and injuries that we associated with that. We benefited from the fantastic forecasting from the National Hurricane Center and the National Weather Service. People saw what happened during Harvey and did not want to be placed in the same situation of having to be rescued, so they got themselves to a place of safety. There were a lot of challenges. You know, the fuel availability was a real challenge for us. Trying to get people to a place of safety quickly was a challenge for us. The power outage on the back end of the storm was a challenge for us. But overall, we were both fortunate in that we had trained and prepared and exercised appropriately, and we were lucky. You know, that storm, Irma, took the path. If you have to have a major hurricane hit your state, it took about the best path that it could in that situation. It passed between Key West and Marathon, and so did not impact either of those communities as much as it was the residential area in between. And once it hit the peninsula, it worked its way inland over a more rural area of the state, did not cause some severe storm surge in the Naples and Fort Myers area, bypassed Tampa and the potential deadly storm surge that would occur there. So I don't want to downplay the severity of the storm, and, you know, any loss of life is terrible. But as far as it, you know, I think we came out of there about as good as we could have in that situation.
Well, I can't imagine another state more prepared and whose residents are more aware of all of these things that can happen. You know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, some people just kind of stick their head in the sand and, well, that won't happen here. But you know, in Florida, it probably has happened there, or people know that it's going to. So I would guess that they are more prepared than most people are. And, yeah, and you're always learning something new.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, we covered all three of the hurricanes. We did extensive coverage here on the show. We were doing, in some cases, two episodes a week instead of our regular weekly schedule. We were checking in with Sam and Joe and some of the other team members that were deployed. When they had a break, they'd call in and we'd record on the fly and get some things, get information out to our audience about what was going on the ground and what they were experiencing. And I have to say, just watching the way Florida planned for this event and all the things that you did to get to make it possible for that many people to evacuate. I mean, and one of the challenges that I saw was, you know, for a lot of states, you can go in three directions and get out of the state, or four directions and get out of the state for the states in the center of the country. But in Florida, you had to drive the length of the state to get out. And for a lot of those people that were in harm's way. And I just was amazed by the ways that the state was planning to do things like get gasoline to the gas stations so that they could fuel up the cars so they could keep driving. Not something you really think about unless you're a planner at your level and saying, hey, we've got to be able to get the fuel to the cars so they can drive, you know, that long distance to get out the north end of the state.
Yeah, there were a lot of challenges there. I think the bottom line that you come out with that thing is if you're a planner, if you're an emergency manager, plan for that worst case scenario. Think through what would happen there. Don't plan for, you know, the medium size event. Plan for that worst case scenario, because it's going to come sometime or another. You might as well be prepared for it now. Think through those scenarios and get everybody on board with that, because there's no point in preparing for something less and then exceeding that and then you not knowing what you're going to do. So, you know, that's a lesson that you hear from you hear Craig Fugate talk a lot about when he was FEMA administrator and also had my job in Florida before I did, which is, you know, plan for those worst case scenarios because they're going to hit you someday.
Well, Brian, here's a specific question. And I had an aunt that used to live in Sarasota. And of course, most of Sarasota has a has a very elderly population, or at least they did at one time. How does Florida handle situations where they know there's a lot of elderly that can't, you know, get out on their own or maybe don't have transportation? What's the plan for that? I'm just curious.
Yeah, there's all of Southwest Florida, basically from St. Petersburg on down to the Naples area. Beautiful part of the state, but, you know, an elderly part of the state. So it's a variety of things. The Florida has a whole state agency called the Department of Elder Affairs that was a good partner for us at the Division of Emergency Management, and they would be our conduit to help inform those citizens about the challenges that could be associated with hurricanes. You know, because a lot of those folks didn't move to Florida until they were retirees. And so, you know, we've got to hit them with that information as they're starting to, you know, settle down into that next phase of their life. So we used every channel we could in helping to reach those folks via the Department of Elder Affairs, or we did a lot of community outreach at the local level to try to reach those folks. The state has a special needs registry to help understand who's gonna need special services in those kind of situations, so that we can prepare for it, that we have enough shelters in place, that we've got the resources to staff those shelters and the equipment necessary, by understanding, again, how many people in that community are going to need that. We work with the home health care agencies, the nursing homes, those kind of folks to make sure that they have the appropriate plans in place and are ready to take action when necessary. And so it's a combination of all of those things, really understanding the demographic and the challenges they're going to face in that situation and being prepared for it. So it might mean, again, greater outreach, different forms of communication, transportation systems to assist those folks, whatever necessary to meet the customer's needs. And, you know, that was the great part of Florida's emergency management is that it was really strong there at the local level as well. And so those local emergency managers had terrific relationships in their community and truly understood the needs of that community and were able to address those specifically. So that was the factors that we did there again. You just really have to understand, and it varied across the state as well. You know, is in some parts of the state you had a greater foreign language speaking component, or maybe it was a younger group, or you had college students, and that really the state would help create the broader overall messaging, and the counties would take it and tailor it to those specific groups. And that's the way we were able to be successful.
Stumper Gumby, huh? Got to be flexible.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So last question, what you doing in Puerto Rico?
Well, thanks for asking. You know, one of the things that I'm doing now, I work in the private sector. I work for a company called IEM. I was with the state of Florida for about 7 years, and although it was a fantastic job, I loved every single day of it. I was appointed by the governor. I was a political appointee. His term as an office is up soon, and so I knew my time in that job was going to be up soon, so I started looking for additional opportunities. You know, the funny thing was I'd actually accepted the job with IEM and tendered my resignation to the governor, and it was about to be announced on the day that Irma formed. I ended up pulling back the resignation and sticking around to make sure that I got through the hurricane safely. But now I work for a company called IEM, which is an emergency management consulting company. We have had folks working on the ground here in Puerto Rico since Irma. A component of our company does airlift operations, airport management, those kinds of things. So we've had folks on the ground here ever since, helping to get the airports back up and running, helping with all of the aviation requirements that have been ongoing here in Puerto Rico for the last 6 months. So I'm down here visiting with our folks here, as well as there's a tremendous amount of needs that Puerto Rico is going to have going forward in terms of rebuilding. And so I'm down here again, working with my colleagues, working with my counterparts, helping to develop those solutions for Puerto Rico so that we can get them back up on their feet as quickly as possible, rebuild the houses, rebuild the economy, get the recovery going, restore a sense of normalcy as quickly as possible. And frankly, as we've been talking about mitigation this whole time, put into place some of the mitigation stuff that I've been preaching for years so that the next hurricane that hits Puerto Rico will not be as devastating as Maria was. And so that's my hope. That's the whole purpose of being down in Puerto Rico, with the secondary benefit of I get to skip all the winter storms that everybody else is experiencing.
I knew there was a corollary there, but you're doing good things. And we appreciate people like you out there trying to make the world safe for the next one that comes along. So, Kyle, any final thoughts?
No final thoughts from me. I thought this was an incredible episode and a great discussion. And I think with the wide audience that we have here for the Disaster Podcast, everyone from the local level, from the citizens all the way on through to the leadership in the local communities, can take something away from this episode to, continue their path towards resilience or to build upon their current successes. So really, thank you, everyone, so much for a great episode tonight.
Absolutely. This was great. So, Jamie, it's too bad Dr. Joe couldn't be here, but I'm sure he's going to listen to this one and enjoy it quite a bit.
He emailed me we were recording and couldn't make it because his meeting went long, but that's okay. We got a great episode here with Brian, and some of the things he talked about, the need for a combination of a broader federal initiative to prepare for things, the state push to prepare a broader community in the local level and then down to the local government. So all that happens. but it comes down to being prepared in the, to begin with, and doing practice and training and making efforts to make sure all the responders and all the local emergency managers are on the same page so they know what to do when these things happen. And that's one of the things that our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group, are really good at. Dr. Joe and Jim and the rest of the team bring experienced disaster responders into local jurisdictions, like the people that are listening to the show, you know, our audience, and prepare you for whatever customized event you think you need to be training for at that given time. And they can put together things for everything, for man-made to natural disasters to things maybe you didn't expect, but maybe they can point you in a direction to consider being prepared for. And I think that's something that, that Brian talked really well about. So I want to encourage everybody to check out our sponsor. Make sure you stop over and say hi to them. Thank them for supporting the show for this last 4 or 5 years. We couldn't do it without them. And so you can go to paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can also head over and find them on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU. And of course, there's links on our Disaster Podcast website at disasterpodcast.com. And you can always reach out to them on our Facebook group as well and touch base with Dr. Joe and Jim and the rest of the team that check in over there quite frequently as well.
Yeah, Brian, we'll have to keep in touch with you because you're going to be out there having other great adventures. Hopefully not too many disaster-related adventures, but, you know, this is, you're doing something entirely different than what we do, and we really enjoy hearing about your level of involvement in these things. So let's do keep in touch. In fact, maybe we can coerce you into coming onto our Facebook page, and people may have questions specific to this.
That sounds fun. I'd love to do that.
Well, that's great. We'll definitely make sure you connect. The easiest way to find us is just to search for Disaster Podcast in Facebook. You'll see the Facebook group come up. Just request to join, and we'd be happy to have you. We have about 600 people in there at various levels of emergency management and disaster response, so it's a good place to connect with people as well. And if people have any questions when this episode gets posted, they can post them in the comments there. You know, it's great to check in with you. In the meantime, is there a place that they can reach out to you or connect with you online yourself, maybe through your new position at IEM or something like that?
Sure, yeah. My email address is brian.koon, that's brian.koon@iem.com. You can reach me through our website at IEM.com, or you can just call me, 850-519-7966 gets to me.
Awesome. And thanks again for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Hey, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social media sites under the handle WXKyleNelson. Feel free to connect with me there and continue the conversation.
We will do so. Sam, how about you?
Well, you'll find me with Kyle on the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 on the disasterpodcast.com website and certainly in our Facebook group. How about you, Jamie?
Well, I can be found under the handle PodMedic in most social media places as Sam's dog is chirping away at the background. So that means it's time to end the show. But find me under the handle PodMedic in most places. We'd love to hear from you and connect and follow me over there. Of course, disasterpodcast.com is our website. And I think that's how we actually connected with Brian was somebody left a comment over there in our contact page. And we were able to follow up with that. And I'm so glad we did. So if you'd like to recommend somebody you know or yourself even to come on the show, you can do that over at disasterpodcast.com on our contact page, and we will try to get back to you as quickly as possible and maybe schedule you to come on the program. Sam, you know, we've talked about a lot of things about preparedness, but, you know, this concept of mitigation and resilient communities in a lot of different ways, whether it's being more prepared through training, whether it's being more prepared because we have better building codes and better systems in place to mitigate the effects of these events when they happen. It's all an important part of the process.
It is, and it's just, you know, I'm glad we had this discussion because it's something we need more of, and I hope people really take heed to this. But, you know, it's just another example, even though we're not talking a lot about medicine so much, but maybe disaster mitigation is not your everyday mitigation.